It is called In a Cell. I thought it would be exactly right for this subject. It's somewhat lengthy. Okay. In this cell, I'm giving fair ones to all my demons, and every nightmare wakes up to worse dreaming. But that's just life in a cell. And you sort of have to imagine him reading it. I always feel sort of silly reading this because he reads it in his own special way. But months without mail makes days slow as a mile to a snail. I try to smile to prevail, while inside I feel more foul than sheets in a cheap motel. And sometimes only a growl can stop the fail. But that's just life in a cell. Sometimes it's hard to really catch my breath. It's like I'm slapboxing with the angel of death. And that nigga cheats, so I'm looking for a ref, but that's how it is in a cell. Coping every day is in this tragedy, every day in this tragedy, hoping I won't turn into a tragic me. Prison has its own gravity. Every year it increases its potency. As it changes me, I fight to remain some of the me that I used to be, but that's RIP in this prison's hell. I watch many come to prison because they terrorize all through their lives. They watch their errors rise, but once in a cell, they find out their mirror lies as they watch tears drip and rip from clearer eyes, but that's just life in a cell. Too many of us want to be gangsta, and we talk too much. On the streets with the heat, we plot too much, end up in prison, get caught too much, or early to the grave, got shot too much. But that's life in our hoods, as it manufactures inmates like a factory and gets us perfectly ready for the cell therapy of living in a cell. It's hard to answer the question, what was in my head? What made me pull the trigger and make somebody else dead? What was the thing that died inside me that made me kill another and start this insanity? It started with arrested development that led to an incarcerated mind within a neighborhood prison factory that paved my way to a prison cell. But that's just the kind of things you recognize after a con wrecks, then lets cognition rise. And you reckon and then realize with real eyes when you're doing life in a cell. Every regret gets revisited 1,000 times, and everything you wished you didn't say gets unsaid, and you create new lifelines, and everything you wish you did say gets immaculately designed. But this all happens in your goddamn mind, and all it is the time doing you instead of doing the time. But sometimes that's just your life when you're living in a cell. I wish I could find a way to release me, if not physically, at least set my mind free. But instead, I'll just go make a chi-chi and try to find something half-decent on the TV. But after the credits and my stomach's full because I fed it, I'm back to trying to forget. But then I forgot what I forgot to forget in the first place. And that happens when living life in the worst place, confined in your mind while confined in the cell. I wish I could erase the erasing of my years, because now that I'm sitting here, it's clear that my criminal choice was like listening to peer pressure from a suicide circle's voice. And my tragic actions were like self-mutilating my social self, until I received the attraction of death's satisfaction. And as my soul succumbs, it's like my mind stays numb, because it refuses to let me see that I should have let go of people and hopes and dreams that have long ago let go of me. But that can't happen because of the release, because in that release, every piece of a fragmented piece that I managed to lease would greatly decrease. And when the illusion dies, the only conclusion alive is that my closest thing to truth is my most ardent life, is my most ardent lie. And the only thing behind my eyes is a me I no longer recognize. But that's what happens when you spend more time than you care to consider living in a cell. It gets to where I can no longer fake it and don't care if I make it. Every day exposing staff like getting naked for a strip and search and watching them become more afraid than if white Jesus actually did go to a ghetto black church. I'm sick of watching my decisions clowned and tired of hiding my pride in the back pocket of my prison browns. And I will keep my fake smile turned upside down because I realize the reality that to the DOC, all I am and all I will ever be is the contents of a cell. The cell kills anything resembling a loving relationship. It chokes them until they fail and makes people jump ship and bail. The cell kills anything resembling real friendship or true kinship because it only survives through J-pay slips and holiday mail. So just despite this is why I write this. It's against reality that I rebel. So when the gate opens, my task is to adjust the mask. Before I leave the place, I say I hate. But how can that be true when I finish what I do? It's the place that I quickly rush back to, this cell. So this is, God, every time I read it, it's very, very powerful. I would say about that poem that Malachi wrote that when he was in a particularly rough spot, you know, in his life. And the one sort of good news, I think, is that when he was talking about, you know, all of the relationships that he lost and how isolated he is, soon after that, he actually got back together with his sort of love of his life, his girlfriend from before he was incarcerated. And so he's right now feeling much better than he was when he wrote that about a lot of things. So I want to segue from that into this five things that I have come to understand better about the prison, because 5 years ago I had spent almost no time in the prisons. I had gone one time with Norm to a prison class that he was teaching, maybe twice by that point, to the prison and to the jail. But basically, I knew nothing about what life was like in the prison. And there were some really basic things that I didn't understand, that I came to understand just through spending some time there. And so that's what I'm going to try to convey. And I guess the first insight that I got of these five insights is that, first, there is a reason that I didn't know much about life inside the prison. It wasn't just a coincidence that I didn't happen to know much about what was going on in the prisons. And as I was going into the prisons, I started increasingly to realize that I had avoided knowing about what prisons were like, right? And it's easy to do that because prisons, the walls around prisons, prevent you from seeing in them. You know, in Pennsylvania, particularly, they're really careful about not allowing any images from prisons to get out. Like, you're not allowed to take images from within prisons and show them. There's a couple of exceptions to that. But there's a lot of effort that's being put into not letting people understand what prisons are like, right? But then in addition to that, I think we all don't want to understand. I don't know if we can all think of examples, probably, I know I can, of times when you were the witness to something in your personal life that something really bad was happening around you, and it came out later. And then you look back and you thought, oh, I knew that. You know, we've had stories like that in my extended family where there was abuse going on in the family, and everybody kind of knew that it was happening, but nobody really knew that it was happening, and nobody wanted to know it was happening. So later on, it becomes very obvious that this abuse had occurred, right? You know, and everybody kind of, over the next few years, kind of sat there and said, I knew about that, you know. I don't know why I didn't, in retrospect, step forward, you know, and do something, right? And I think the prison's like that. I think that one thing about the prison is that, as I came into the prison, I started to realize, oh, I kind of knew this, you know? But then I was faced with it, you know, in real life when I walked in. And so I just want to, what are the things that I got to understand better about what's going on in the prison that I kind of already knew, but they became unavoidable to me when I kept on seeing them in real life. So I first got into this prison, which was SCI Pittsburgh, which has since been closed down. SCI Pittsburgh was the main prison, right, for people who were medium to minimum security in from this region, from Western Pennsylvania, or from, you know, the Pittsburgh area. So most people, I think, in there were Pittsburgh, were from the Pittsburgh area. One thing that really surprised me when I walked in the first time to this prison was that when once you get through security to get in, everybody's just walking around, and it's like you're in a town, right? And, you know, there's some people who are being sort of herded, you know, or, you know, a little bit by the guards. You know, they're walking in groups, you know, with the guard, you know, kind of making sure that everybody just stays in a group, right? But in general, you're walking through an open prison yard, and there's people talking in groups and people playing games and, you know, whatever they're doing. And I remember thinking, how is this even possible? This is a dangerous situation. Why are they letting me just, you know, walk through this dangerous situation? Aren't these people going to assault me? You know, or, you know, isn't there some... But I realized there was, like, I came to feel very comfortable just walking into the prison. And it wasn't just me. All sorts of people just, you know, walking in, walking through the prison, no problem. Sometimes they forget to escort us, you know, and they would just, you know, we just go on through. You know, often there was, like, no guard present. And I realized it's because it's not a dangerous situation, right? It really... At least, you know, sometimes it can be dangerous, but it sure didn't seem like a dangerous situation. So that was my first insight. I was like, oh, I'm just in a sort of town full of men who are walking around, right? And they don't seem particularly interested in menacing me, you know, right now. But then once I got in, I started talking to people. I started realizing the things I'd heard little stories about the treatment of men in prison. It's really bad. Like, it's really bad how people are treated in these prisons, right? And I think everybody already knows it, so it almost seems like I shouldn't have to say it. But I also think that even if we know it, there's a level in which we don't know it, right? We know it. It's like if you'd ask, are people, you know, how's the food in prison? What do you guess the food is like in prison, right? Is it tolerable to you? You know, do you think it's okay, the level of food that's being, you know, served in prison? You're probably like, well, I don't really know what it is, but it probably should be better. I'm guessing that's probably where, you know, probably we'd like to see people have healthier food in prisons, right? But, like, the food in prison can be, you know, really, really bad. Like, people are hungry, you know, in prisons, and, you know, they don't get enough, like, vegetables. They can't have fresh food. Fruit and vegetables, you know, like just basic, people don't look healthy in prisons, like when you see them, you know, a lot of people are very unhealthy. Now, a lot of people in prisons are in for a really long time, they're getting older, right? You know, there's a lot of people in prisons, you know, but a lot of people just really look sort of pale and just, there's a lot of just sort of basic health problems that seem to be connected to like nutrition, right? You can't get, like, if you're in a prison and you feel like you need more spinach or you feel, you know, you don't have any option. Your friends have no way. You can send gift packs to people, but those gift packs of food, you can send extra food to people, but all you can get is junk food. You know, and Amber talked about this, but, you know, all you can do is bring in chips and stuff like that. If somebody needs an apple, you know, or it's like, boy, I really feel like I might be getting scurvy, you know, because I'm not gonna, you know, you can't, there's no way that they can control what kinds of food, right, they're taking in as far as, like, healthful food. So there's a real problem with foods in prison. There's a huge problem with healthcare in prison. And I kept on hearing about this, but especially, you know, there's a lot of people in prison. There's a cancer ward, right, in the SCI Pittsburgh. There was a cancer ward there. So the people who are, you know, suffering from cancer in prisons, you know, people walking around in walkers on prisons, you know, people, you know, with like the, you know, the walking sticks and stuff like that in the prison. So a lot of people need a lot of health care, right? And the health care that they're getting is, you know, really, really poor. And you keep on hearing these crisis stories, but like Malachi, for instance, has MS, right? Malachi has MS. He's, how old is he, like 50?
50, early 50s.
Yeah, he's in his early 50s. He's been diagnosed with MS, right? And so it's hard for him to walk around, and his eyes are going, right, and stuff like that. And his mom, who is really works hard to take care of him, you know, Harriet, you know, she is trying to be his advocate to get his pills. But, like, he won't get his pills. Like, they'll just not show up. The medication he's supposed to be taking, that they've been told by the prison he should be taking, just isn't there, you know. And so she has to decide, how much do I remind them? You know, how much do I complain that he's not getting his pills? Because I don't want to anger them, because that could be bad for him, right? You know, so she's really having to navigate, how much do I advocate for his health care? You know, it's just, but it's that kind of level of thing. That's the one that sort of hit closest to home. But it's really bad, right? You know, the, you know, people just going in and saying, oh, I feel pain, you know, and the doctor's just saying, well, take an aspirin, you know, and then later it turns out, you know, their appendix is ruptured, or, you know, it's just like, it's like, that's a, you know, that's a specific story, but just not having the ability to advocate for yourself, and not having a caring medical system can be really fatal to people. So there's that kind of thing. Mental health care. I don't know, you guys picked up, those of you who were here last week, picked up that Oscar, and actually Khalifa did the same thing. They are peer counselors. Did you guys pick that up? So when somebody has a mental health crisis, they send in Oscar, right? They send in Oscar to help, right? Well, that's interesting. Oscar may not be the worst choice, right? But Oscar isn't a trained medical professional. You know, Oscar's a good guy, you know, who has some time, you know, and would like to help, right? He's maybe gone through a week training, right? But they don't have mental health. They have mental health professionals. But the people who are in there, you know, do not get the kind of mental health care. I know there are a lot of people in there who are mentally ill, a lot, right? And they're not getting the kind of mental health care that they, you know, you would kind of hope that would be available to them at all. You know, and then there's like day-to-day things like, you know, people sort of, it just being a humiliating experience to be in prison. You don't have, because you don't have rights, people who choose to treat you poorly, who have more power, there's no way you can keep that from happening. So the most striking example I had of that was one of our think tank members, Fly. We were having an event that, there's so many things I could say about this event, but there was an event which involved people coming in from outside the prison, a lot of people, right? And so there were a lot of people who worked for the various prisons who were coming in for this event. And then we were there, and a lot of incarcerated people were there, and it was this big, big event, right? And in between parts of the event, all the prisoners, they seated them all in the back of this event, in the back rows. And they seated all the, you know, special guests in the front rows. So first of all, that was awkward because it was very much a racial division, though not entirely, but there was definitely that, right? And then they did things like, they went, when time came for lunch, they gave us a lunch with this event. They had all of the free people eat first in front of the incarcerated people. And while they sat there in their rows, they weren't allowed to move. And then they got up and they had their dinner. But we had to like sit there and eat in front of them, you know, while they sat there and watched us eat. And then they could come up and get their food. And it just felt really like slave days, you know. Yes?
Political problem?
Yes.
Why isn't somebody, that's simple.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and it's an economic problem, because what they do is they let it out to the same company, what is it, Aramark, or, you know, whatever, one of these...
They can tell Aramark what they want.
You could say what level of food. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And so, but they have to decide how much they're going to pay for it. You know, so it becomes this question of how much are we going to invest in the nutrition, and then how much are we going to regulate what happens inside the prison, which nobody really wants to do either because it's unpleasant, and you know, so it's also hard, I think, to keep Aramark compliant because it's hard for credible people in the prison who have the time to be thinking about the food quality and measuring it to get their voices out. Excuse me?
Is it It isn't in the private sector.
Well, Aramark is. They contract out to
people would hire Aramark.
Yeah.
They have responsibilities to somebody.
Yes. They should, and I couldn't. That's a great point, and I couldn't agree more. And I think what happens is that within the prison, the prisoners don't have a voice. Nobody's going to listen to the prisoners. They're the ones who care most about the quality of food, but they don't really have any way to communicate that problem, right? So it would have to be people working for the prison. People working for the prison. There's many awesome people working for the prison, right? Many people who really, like I in general, and that's actually my fifth point, you know, is that the problem isn't really lying with necessarily the people who work at the prison, right? There's some great people working at the prison who would care. They're super overworked, super overburdened, you know, and they just, there isn't that extra level of energy to say, I'm going to make sure everything's running properly. Everybody's kind of doing their job, you know, in an emergency mode, and there's nobody who's going to step back and say, I'm going to take individual responsibility to make sure these prisoners get fed, right? So it's kind of like this, it's a sort of lack of people having energy and responsibility for these things, I think. But yeah, no, that's a really good point. But I was at this thing and the prisoners got fed last and it was embarrassing and everything like that. But then I was talking to this one guy who was in our group. His name is Fly, and I sort of walked over to this group where the men were sitting, and he and I were having this conversation, and I don't know, like about political things actually, and this prison guard walked by him. And shoulder checked him, just hit him real hard in the shoulder with his shoulder. Well, and I'm used to being treated with a certain amount of deference as a sort of middle-class white woman. And people don't usually walk up to people who I'm talking to and just bowl into them, right? And just like, you know, it was clearly intentional. And it was a guard, you know, and I was talking to an inmate. And it was a white guard. It was a black inmate. And Fly just kind of, you know, and sat down. And he's like, we can't talk. And he sat down. And I thought, what just happened? I didn't understand. I think I went to Norm and I said, what? I explained what happened. I said, what was that? Like, he said that guard didn't like Fly talking to a white woman. You know, he said, I think that's what happened. We can't be sure. We can't get inside his mind, right? You know, that kind of thing where then Fly, the thing that struck me most about it was that Fly couldn't defend himself or say, hey, that's not fair. You know, like, you know, our conversation was not, you know, inappropriate or, you know, anything like that. So there's like the sort of daily humiliation and no way to sort of deal with that kind of thing, you know, which is also a big problem in the prison. And then the last thing that, like, I think everybody already knows about that happens in prison, but we don't really know it, or we don't let ourselves know it, is there's very little interest in rehabilitation, right? And there's lip service paid to rehabilitation, right? But, like, when I first was working there, we were shocked to find that one thing, the lifers that we were working at with, right, they're not getting out. They're a life person. They might, you know, they might get pardoned, right? But unless they get like a pardon or, you know, they're not going to get out. And that's just really unlikely. What they do with their time in large part is try to prepare other people for getting out. Like that's their mission, right? Is like they're going to try to support other people who are getting out. They're trying to like sort of live vicariously through them. What struck me was that first of all, they didn't seem to have any competition, right? They seemed to be the people who were doing that, right? And that's not quite true, right? There's some people who come in and like, oh, we're going to help. But in general, they experienced themselves as the only group who were helping people figure out how to adjust when they were getting out, right? And they had this packet that they would give to everybody. And it was a Xerox packet. It was like 20 pages long, Xerox packet. And it had a list of places that will help you if you're recently incarcerated, right? But it was from like years ago, right? Things were like X'd out. it was like with a typewriter, because I don't have access to word processors, you know, things like that. And they were still, and that was the packet that people were getting. When they got out, they'd get this like typewritten packet put together by a group of other inmates, you know, about like who to call when you get out. And I felt like that really sort of said it all about, you know, like what was going on, you know. And so they said, people, you know, the recidivism rate is what, you know, I'm going to say 70%, you know, 80%, something like most people are getting out are coming right back in, right? But there's not, there doesn't, you'd think that there would be this like energetic effort, you know, like, oh, we're going to be throwing all of our best stuff at like figuring out how to solve this problem of recidivism. But we're not. We're throwing, you know, Oscar and Khalifa at the problem of recidivism, right? Which is cool, and they're great. You know, I mean, they may be the answer, right? But it would really be helpful if they had more resources and, like, you know, professionally trained people, you know, and things like that, you know, were sort of working along the same lines. So that's, I'm only through my first point. My first point is, there's a reason we don't know much about how people are treated in prisons. And the reason is that we know it, right, but we don't know it. Right? We allow ourselves to not know it because knowing it costs money, right? And knowing it is unpleasant. Okay, the second thing I wanted to, that I learned about being in, while being in prisons, about life in prison, is that people who are incarcerated often understand their arrests as having a structural cause rather than having been caused by acts that they committed, okay? So now, we can agree or disagree. The people that we work with, generally speaking, committed murders, right? You know, but in general, people who are incarcerated seem to have an understanding of the reasons of their incarceration as structural, right? They seem to think, yeah, I did this thing, or I didn't do this thing, for which I was incarcerated, right? But I was part of a broad system that led me to do this thing that isn't being acknowledged, right? And so that there isn't this kind of sense of penitent people, guilty people sitting around. You know, Malachi, and his poem's a little bit of an exception, right? He definitely feels guilty about, you know, his crime. He was actually on death row for a while for that, before he was moved to life. But in generally speaking, they tend to think, have a richer understanding of the context of the crime. And so, for instance, when you look at the histories of somebody like Oscar, you know, and Amber talked about Oscar, you know, and he committed this murder, perhaps, right? But when you look into Oscar's history, you know, she mentioned that he was raised largely going out to the prison to visit his father and stuff like that, right? But, you know, Oscar once told a story, and took him a couple years to get to it, but he told a story about a time when he was woken in the night by a neighbor who was basically saying, you know, you guys get in the bathroom. And a neighbor took his brother, who's also incarcerated now, and himself into this bathroom and locked the door with them. And it was his father was trying to kill his mother outside. And with a pipe, a neighbor ultimately, but was beating her in the head with a pipe. And a neighbor ultimately came out with a gun, which was unloaded, didn't have ammunition, but came out with his gun and managed to stop this with this unloaded gun. Their mother was not killed, right? And Oscar, somehow this was the detail that got to me. He was 11 or 12 or something like that. His brother was about the same age. Oscar later went out with a neighbor, I don't know if it was the same one or not, and cleaned the blood off the sidewalk you know, in front of his house, like himself, you know, helped out to clean, right? And it's like, you go through things like that, you know, and you're, you know, and it's just, I think, like, the world to Oscar, you know, it just looks much more complicated. You know, it's not like, well, you should, everybody should follow the rules, and then you won't have to go to prison. You know, you can, like, you know, that kind of, like, simple world wasn't one that was really present to him, you know, that he could see the possibility of or understand what that would mean. You know, so there's no question that he, or I guess there is a question, you know, whether or not he committed this crime, or whether, I think maybe the question is whether it's second degree or first degree is the real question. You know, he has an understanding that the reason that he's in prison is not just that he made one bad act. You know, that he has an understanding that the reason that he's in prison was that his life was cursed. You know, like, you know, it was like, and you know, that it was just kind of, he feels like it was kind of a natural, inevitable thing, right? You know, and I think that that's probably true for a lot of people when they're incarcerated. They have a structural understanding. You know, if you take, you know, a kid who's born into one of those communities now, I don't know exactly what the number is, but I want to say your chances of going to prison if you're a young man, a child born into one of those communities now, I want to say it's 1 in 2. Maybe it's higher than that, though. Do you have that?
This is more specific.
Yeah.
Generally, it's 1 in 3 African-American men are ensnared in the criminal justice system.
But if you're in a poor neighborhood and if you have incarcerated people in your family, the chances you're a child, if you're a child, you know, with incarcerated men, an African-American child from, you know, say Homewood with incarcerated men in your family, the chances you're not going to go to prison, it's really a minority chance, right? That's your most likely thing in your life is that you're going to end up in prison. I'm confident that that's true, right? So I think it's, so for them going to prison isn't like, oh, I messed up, you know, or, oh, I did something sinful, or, you know, it's more like I'm part of a system that ends up, you know, putting you into prison, you know, naturally, right? So it's a very different, and I hadn't really understood that about prison sort of until I started to spend time there. A third point I wanted to make about prison, I had one other thing I wanted to say about that, which was I was so fascinated by the first week when Michelle said, and I had heard Khalifa say this himself, but when Khalifa and Michelle in the first week said, Khalifa says that maybe he should not have been incarcerated so long for, you know, for life, right, for the thing he was incarcerated for, right? But he said, I've done other things I wasn't caught for, and so it was probably right that I should have had this incarceration. You know, she made that comment that he actually doesn't feel that he was wrongly incarcerated. And I thought, is he saying he committed another murder? Like, is that what he's saying? You know, what is he saying? You know, why does he? Because he had said that before. I thought, well, is he like somehow wasn't caught for a murder? I mean, it's possible, right? But it seemed to me, as I was thinking about it, I was like, why would he make that statement? It seemed to me like there's this desire to believe that you have some agency over your life, right? It's like, how would it be if you got to the very end of your life? He knew he was dying, right? You know, somehow he knew a few years before he was diagnosed with cancer. He was already saying, I'm not going to live very long, right? He knew he was dying. How would it feel to get to the very end of your life and feel that you were wrongly, unfairly, somehow, you know, whether because you didn't commit the crime or because you felt the punishment regime was unfair, you felt like you never had a chance or whatever. I to feel like you were unfairly incarcerated for your entire life and now you're going to die, right? Like, it's really pretty depressing, right? Like, it's like, you know, I would think that there would actually be an impulse to say, I did have control over this. You know, I did bring this upon myself. You know, so one thing I was kind of thinking about when she said that, I thought maybe he wanted to feel like he had some agency over his life, you know, some control over his life, you know, at the very end, when it became clear to him that he was never getting out. Okay. The third thing was people who are incarcerated cannot speak freely. And that's actually one of the impulses. Yes?
Is there any other discussion of religion in any of this?
In any of what?
Their reasoning in line with this?
Yeah, when they make sense of
Christ, God.
There's a lot. And, I mean, Khalifa was a was probably the most, maybe Sean, the most religious of the men who are in our group. But Khalifa was a chaplain, you know, among the many hats that he wore. He was a spiritual leader for a lot of people in the prison. I think Sean did some of that too, actually. I believe that that's true. Both of them, Christianity was very important to them. Malachi, not, you know, he really was in a place of despair religiously. You know, he felt very black inside, you know, deserted, like he had no hope, right, at the time that we were talking about. And he really experienced that because he tried, you know, to at different times to have religion, you know, and he failed to be able to do that. I don't know where he is right now religiously, now that he's happier.
He was a Muslim at one point, and he's talking about converting back to Christianity.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know his new partner, or his old new partner, Jewel. I don't know what her religion is, but I imagine that would be influential. Is she a pastor? Okay. Yeah, no, so Christianity is super important, you know, to how people process this experience and try to give it some sort of meaning. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Yeah. Okay, they can't speak freely. And that's another thing which it was crazy to me to go into these prisons, because you know how kids lie a lot, right? Like children just like lie a lot. And, you know, my own children, unfortunately, including them, you know, even my, like, teenager, you know, very fine people, not super honest people all the time, right? And I've tried to figure out, like, what's up with that? And I was like, oh, it's because they don't have any power in relationship to me. They have no hope of convincing me to do the thing that they want to do in some cases when it involves video games or whatever. Like, they have no hope that through honest discourse, you know, we will come up with a solution that is appealing to them, right? And so they will deceive and lie, right, out of a position of powerlessness at some point. And incarcerated people are in often the same position where they can't speak freely, or there's no good to speaking freely, no good to trying to convince people of things honestly, because they know that it won't work, right? They know that nobody's listening. They know that nobody understands them. And they know that they can get in trouble if they don't say the thing that's expected of them, right? So, for instance, one thing that they have to do is, like, when they try to go up for when they apply to get a pardon, which they do from time to time, they put in their paperwork to get a pardon, and the pardons never come, right? When they do that, one thing that they have to do is not try to sound like they're justifying their crime. Okay, so when you put in your pardon letter, you have to be like, I did it. It was wrong. There was nothing justifying it, and now I regret it. And now, please, you know, give me a pardon, right? But you can't be like, I was a victim of this, or like, well, the guy was threatening me, or like, you know, you can't do anything like that. There's a particular way you have to ask for a pardon, and that means you have to tell your story in a particular way. And it's not the way that anybody thinks about their own crime, right? In fact, they feel like there were a lot of reasons why they committed their own crime. And yet, if they want to get a pardon, they have to write the story in a particular way. And their lives in general are like that, that they have to speak, they have to, what Malachi said in that poem, they have to put on the mask, right? And again, it reminded me a lot of slavery, right, where, you can't, or, you know, being a child, but just, you know, being disempowered, you know, that you that one thing that you're really not allowed to do is sort of tell your own story and, like, explain who you are in your own terms. And that's something that's really hard. One thing we're hoping to do with this book, you know, is give people a space to try to explore and tell their own stories in a way that's safe for them. It's easier sometimes for lifers because the pardon is a pie in the sky, you know, and there's, in a sense, they've already been punished as much as they can be punished, so they can speak more freely than some other people. But, and then the fourth thing we've talked about a lot, which is people who are incarcerated are often richly tied into broader communities. That's something that I think has been striking to all of us listening to Amber and Michelle, right? Because they're like, oh yeah, you know, we go all the time to the prison. We bring our kids to prison. You know, we were raised going to the prison, you know. But one thing that we really noticed, I really noticed in this group when I was meeting with these men, and they would joke about it. They say, our families call us more for support than we call them. You know, they'll get all these, you know, talk to your grandson. He's not studying. You know, tell him, Khalifa's, I think this was Khalifa, you know, his daughter was like telling her son, like, your grandfather's taking a college class and you can't even get through, you know, fifth grade. you're not even doing your fifth grade homework and stuff like that. But all of this, you know, that people in prisons are very much part of communities and very much needed as part of communities. They marry, they remarry, you know, they meet new people. They're sort of like richly tied into these communities. And you would kind of say, well, who would marry an incarcerated person, right? You know, why would you do that? They can't give you any money. Right? They can't, have conjugal visits, right? They can't be there for you at home. There's a whole bunch of things they can't do, right? And yet, incarcerated people often have no problem at all finding partners, right? Really, no problem at all, right? It's a little bit striking, right? And the partners they find, right, are people like Michelle's mom, you know, Helen, or like Jewel, who are like professional or, you know, employed women, right? You know, who are complete, you know, very healthy, you know, decent, you know, attractive people, right? Who are, Jewel actually, she works at Carnegie Mellon running a science education program, right? And she's a very accomplished, educated person, right? But they go in and they're tied into these men in the prison because the prison is part of the community, right? And because just because somebody is in prison doesn't mean that they're not still a really vibrant part of, you know, all sorts of like social groups outside of the prison. And they have a lot of time to do things like talk and worry about your problems and, you know, things like that. So I think that that's another really important thing about incarcerated, and especially when you have a community where such a high proportion of the men, I always think about this as a Civil War historian. After the Civil War, courtship is all messed up, right? Because there's a lost generation of men. Right, so you have this weirdnesses where people are getting married at the wrong ages, like people are doing really unusual age marriages, right? Because there's this whole generation of women who they've lost a quarter you know, of the men or, you know, whatever, right? And the same thing happens in communities of color with high incarceration rates, right? That you just have the situation where there aren't men, right? They're just, you know, a lot of the men are incarcerated. Like, huge numbers of men from the community just aren't there, you know, or have been killed, right? Because there's a high, very high, you know, homicide rate. Died of disease, right? You know, but largely being killed or, you know, incarcerated. And so I think that's another really important thing to understand about the prisons is that they are inextricably tied in to the broader community. And the fifth thing I was going to say, it actually just came up, but I don't really think that it's fair to say that guards and prison officials are the core problem. One thing I was really struck with, I figured I would really dislike, which is walking in, not knowing anything, I figured I would really dislike the employees of the prison, that I would see them as thugs, right? That I would see that they would be power-hungry. And there are people like that in the prisons, right? But in general, the people that I have met who were guards in the prisons or who were, you know, running the prisons, you know, administrators in the prisons, they're doing all sorts of various tasks in the prisons, are pretty decent people who like would like to do their jobs well, often have really rich relationships with incarcerated people. When Khalifa died, several employees of the prison came out to his funeral, right? People cried, you know, from the prison, you know, were crying at his funeral. You have a lot of really rich relationships, and often guards come from the same neighborhoods, the same families, the same communities that incarcerated people come from, right? So often they know them, you know, anyway, you know, from before they were incarcerated. But I think that it's a mistake that we frequently make to say that a solution to the problems in the prison is to, like, get better guards or, like, you know, control the guards. I think the problem is, like, that can happen. Guards can be awful, like that guy that, you know, ran into Fly. I mean, that was pretty nasty, right? It's pretty aggressive. It's pretty demeaning, right? And it had to be personal. So that stuff happens for sure, and that needs to be controlled. But I think this idea that somehow we can fix the prison system by having better guards, you know, is probably not going to get us very far. So anyway, so those are the kind of the observations, what I know about prisons now, how I think about prisons now differently than I did 5 years ago. I would take any questions people might have. Yeah.
I don't know if the program still exists, but a number of years ago, there was a program called Families Outside, which was organized to get, it was easier when SDR Pittsburgh was still open, the children of the incarcerated to the prisons to visit, and at that time they were showing that those children who were able to maintain a relationship and physically see the parents had less of a chance of going to prison. I'm wondering, is some program like that still in place to try to break there's so many factors, we know that, but if that's one that has data that shows it's helpful to the children, does that get enough attention, or does that not exist anymore?
Well, I mean, of course, one thing that just happened, and we've talked about this, you know, in some of the other ones too, but we just closed down SCI Pittsburgh, and you hate to be sad about a prison closing down, but it was catastrophic when that prison closed down, because it means that if you want to visit your loved one, you have to take a whole day, you have to take $100, you know, you have to get out to whatever place they're at. Sometimes you get to a prison, somehow it's not even open, you know, there's been a problem or something like that, so you have to risk getting out there and having to turn around, you know, so that's been, like, it's gotten much worse as far as visiting incarcerated people for family members. There's vans that are run up, there's a group called Amachi, but I couldn't find it. I was talking to somebody about it, I can't remember, but I can't track it down anymore. Yeah.
That was one of the features of the program, was these were volunteers. Mm-hmm.
There are. I know that there are vans that exist, like, because I've seen them. They're on this sheet of paper. You might even know.
Two little things. I don't have a specific answer to that, but I go down. I'm going down every Friday to SCI Fayette for release, and on the first day and the last day, there was this bus from Philadelphia, a chartered bus. So these people got there 8 in the morning. So what time did they get on this bus in Philadelphia? And they come there, and they'll get to be with their people until like 3:30 in the afternoon. Right? There's been days when they've gotten there, and something happened, and the prison was locked down. So they left Philadelphia whenever they left Philadelphia to get
it has
there.
To be like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it has to be 2 o'clock
yeah.
in the morning.
Yeah.
And they all have little kids, and sometimes they're in pajamas and whatever. And so I don't know how that works locally, but one of the last, they would have these volunteer banquets every year. And one year I really thought I would win the Volunteer of the Year award because I'd done some things. And the guy who won it.
Oh my God.
Was this guy who'd been coming there forever for their Sunday service. He was in a wheelchair. He would take 2 buses, electric wheelchair.
Three buses.
And then he would have to take his wheelchair a mile on this road to get to the prison. And he finally won the Volunteer of the Year. And I was like, it was so humbling. So, I mean, if this guy can't get a ride to the prison, who's going to get, I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's right. So there's not like a real hefty, there's not a lot of resources that you can just say, oh, well, we'll just dig into the, you know, prison transportation fund to make this happen, you know. But that, yeah, that was amazing. Yeah, literally. And and if I could just say, this guy, the road that this guy is going down, what was it called? Was it Chartiers? I can't remember what it was called, but it was
Chateau.
But it was like a fast highway, and without a real, yeah, there's no sidewalk, and there really wasn't much of a, you know, shoulder. So he was just out there on his wheelchair every Sunday to get out there to be a chaplain to these people, you know, 3 buses, and then a mile down this fast highway, you know, in all weather, you know, and I was just like. I think that really says something about, you know, the rest of us, you know. It's like, I was like, I'm sure I would not have done that. I'm not that good. Yeah. But
yeah. So I thought what you said about rehabilitation is really important. And it kind of connects back to what Charlie was saying about policy or politics. Mm-hmm. That the point here is more punishment than rehabilitation. And as far as I can tell from hearing you talk, completely free of grace or any idea of grace. And I'm just wondering, where is the possibility for that to come into the situation?
Yeah.
Into our thinking.
No, I do think...
As a Christian, mm-hmm. how do we bring more grace?
I have often thought about, actually... If I, like, on a personal note, like I used to be an active churchgoer, and I basically have decided to do prison instead of church, right? You know, as a better expression of my faith. You know, not that you can't do both, because you can. But I was feeling like, I'll tell this story. There was this, and then I'll get back to the grace. They need Bibles. Okay, so when you, which is, it's just impossible to imagine, right? But when you move from one prison to another, they're afraid that you're going to like have drugs stuck in the bindings of your books, maybe. So for whatever reason, or a knife or a gun, or I don't know what you might have, and you're in the binding of your book. But so they break the bindings of all your books if you're going from one prison to another, right? So if you're gonna try to bring a book with you, so basically one thing that is often needed is like new Bibles, right? When you go from a place to another, prisoners happen to read a lot of Bibles. So I asked my church, "Hey, you know, we have this need for Bibles," and my church is like, "Awesome. You know, we can totally provide that." And I was like, this is great. Like, we're really seeing Christians coming together to, like, you know. And they gave me these. They were like, I think they felt bad throwing out old Bibles because they're Bibles. So they didn't want to throw them in the trash. But, like, they were, like, Bibles from the 70s, all nasty and gross and stained. And, like, you know, and they gave me, like, these bags of, like, disgusting Bibles, right, and to give to these prisoners. And I was like, I threw them out. You know, I threw them out. I was like, they went right out to my curb. But I was just like, I felt like, That actually, I left the church after that. That was actually the last thing I did with that church. You know, after many years, you know, teaching Sunday school, you know, stuff like that. That was it for me. I didn't believe it. But
members is incarcerated at that church.
Yeah. No, that's right. Yeah. I didn't believe it. But I just thought it's like the least our relationship to the prisons is like the least Christian thing about our culture, right? That's actually exactly why I do it, right? I'm just like, it's like the most obviously un-Christian thing is like the way that we're treating, you know, incarcerated people. But like, where is the space for grace within that? I mean, I think people need to spend more time like getting to know prisoners, going in, doing these programs, which exist. It's not that hard to get involved in them. And need to sort of advocate for humane treatment of prisoners, you know, or just, you know, either sort of politically you can advocate for more humane treatment, just food, you know, and then if you feel, you know, called to it, you know, sentencing reform, you know, things like that, depending on where you are. But I do think that definitely this is a Christian issue.
I realize the issue, but they need to have a better way of getting food to the prisoners, but until something happens, did you say that families and people can bring in junk food but not an apple?
They can't even bring in their own junk food. You have to order junk food from a special company that's gotten a contract to sell the junk food.
Oh.
You can throw it. I mean, I will say my... my partner's brother is frequently incarcerated, and though he's not right now, so that's good. It's like, but he is. So we've had the opportunity to send some stuff to him, you know, through one of these programs, and you can buy him a pizza party. They'll bring a pizza to his cell, you know. But it's like you're. You know, but it's like basically it's all this like really junky food. It's super overpriced, and it's like, you know, they all have like silly names, like, you know, have a lock-up pizza party or something. It's like some sort of like these. It's horrible system. Like, you can't bring healthy food. I remember when I first started coming in, I actually asked Norm. I was like, can we bring food? These guys seem really hungry. Maybe we could bring food to have at our meetings, you know. And I remember Norm said, Elaine, if we were allowed to bring food, I would be bringing food every, you know, all I would. That's all I would do. I would just be bringing food and bringing food. He's like, believe me, you're not allowed to bring any food into this place, you know. And it's like one way. Malachi's mother is a baker. She's a she makes cakes. Especially her pineapple upside down cake is very well received, well thought of, kind of famous as a baker in her community, Homestead. Yeah. And so she said one of the worst things for Malachi is he can never have one of those cakes again, you know, and he talks about it, you know, and the guards will all, when she comes in, because the guards sometimes are from that community, like, you're going to bring some, you know, get some cake. Yeah, you could, like, maybe you could have a knife in the cake that was undetectable by their metal detectors, maybe. I don't know. But I think it's that they don't want you to have the cake. You know, I mean, I'm sure that it's not, you know, people, it's not that individuals are mean. It's just that the way that the structure has been set up, you don't get any goodies. Yeah. And also it's a way to control you, right? Because if you don't have enough food, you're more likely to be compliant so that you can get food. You know, so it's like if you're controlling somebody's food supply, it's easier maybe to control their...
bureaucracy.
Yeah. No, it's hyper-bureaucracy. Every aspect of your life is regimented by this.
They were bringing their daughters,
and they gave the inmates, they provided them with tuxedos and so forth, and they, and their young daughters, teenagers probably, were in gowns, and they danced with them. Huh. And it was the loveliest evening, but then it was so sad at the end when they had to come home.
It's surprising. It's like, it shouldn't be so surprising that, like, and it didn't even have to be like that. It used to be like, when some of these guys started to be incarcerated, they could sometimes wear their own clothes. And it's gotten a lot more regimented in the last, but like even in the 70s, some of these guys were incarcerated since the 70s. And 70s and 80s, you could often wear your own clothes. You could earn the right, if you're in, you know, minimum, medium security, to wear your own clothing. But now, you know, and there, that would mean so much to them if they could just have on a t-shirt, you know, like to have some sort of expression of their personality or individuality, would really mean a lot. And it's sort of like unclear why it's not okay for them to wear their own clothes, you know. But again, it's kind of like, is it really a security issue to wear jeans and a t-shirt? You know, so you could see how you could make a case for why it's important that everybody wear a uniform. But you also kind of like, maybe there's some benefit to letting them wear their own clothes and like feel a little bit more human that might outweigh whatever security benefit you'd get from having everybody wear coverall. Yeah.
I have heard and read about the high incidence of mental illness in all prisons. From your experience, what is your sense for that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's huge.
Would the inmates would be mentally ill?
Well, I mean, I feel like there's a really high incidence of mental illness throughout the entire population. So, like, you know, I feel like, you know, who among us is not mentally ill in some way? But the within the prison, they have special wards. You know, they always have a special, any prison is going to have a special building just for people with mental illnesses so severe that they can't be in the regular population, right? So that's just a regular baked-in part. I have heard that, because now we don't have, you know, since, well, you guys, you know, are going to remember deinstitutionalization in the 70s, we don't have psych wards, right? So we don't have psychiatric hospitals. Though the prisons are, you know, if you're poor, many of us like have a family member or something who struggles with mental illness, and we think, thank God we have the resources to take care of this person, right? But if you don't, they might well end up in the prison. So I don't know percentage. What do you know percentage wise about?
I don't know. I just know it's very high. There's a very old and grizzled sort of hard-boiled prison chaplain who said one time, what these guys need is therapy. They don't need punishment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's huge.
It's really huge. And also just, I remember I was talking to a guard a couple years ago, and he was like, he was saying he had been with an inmate at two different prisons. The inmate had been moved, and he had changed jobs. And the guy was mentally ill, but it was controllable with medication. And he said, well, at one prison, they controlled it with medication. And they required this guy to take his pills, even though he didn't want to. And he was, which we can argue, I don't even know how I feel about this. But he said he was playing chess. He was like, you know, he was a good guy. Like, I enjoyed spending time with him, you know, as a guard. You know, I got to know him. Said he went to the other prison. They didn't require him to take his meds. They didn't force him to take his meds. And he said he's basically in isolation, smearing poop on the wall. And, you know, and that's who he, you know, that's what he's doing now, right? And so, you know, and that was SCI Pittsburgh, where they didn't require him to take the meds, you know. And he said it's just, the guard is like, it's just depressing, because I know this guy, I know him. You know, if he would take these pills, you know, he'd have a very different kind of life, you know. But yeah, there just isn't very good, consistent mental health care, for sure. Yeah. Well, I think
following that, the question with regard to individual responsibility, if, let's say, a third or half of the population in the prison is mentally ill, maybe incapable of individual responsibility. Isn't that a little bit different than maybe our assumption of what we do in prison, of teaching people our, putting down rules that they follow because maybe they're not able to follow them?
Yeah. No, I think that's true. And I do think that one thing that happened is you can't have strong, disturbing, mentally ill people with maybe violent potential or seem like they might be violent walking the streets, right? It just makes everybody feel really uncomfortable and unsafe, right? Maybe it is unsafe. And yet we don't have any other system. So in the end, they end up in the prison. We've had discussions with that, about that in the think tank. And it's basically, some people are in here because they cannot survive outside. Like, they need to be in here. Like, and as soon as they get out, they get right back in because they can't feed themselves, right? They can't survive without somebody marching them to the things they have to go to, right? And that's not most people. You don't want to get it and be like, they're, people in prison are incompetent, but there's a large number of people in prison who it seems like just aren't competent to lead their lives without a pretty robust support structure, and the prison isn't really an ideal way to provide that support structure. Yeah. So I think people have to go. But yeah, thank you very much.